Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where we invite historians to fire for effect. The podcast where history zeroes in and blasts myth and misconception straight to hell. I am your regular host, Paul Babel, and I'm here alone because Kyle has to take a break now from podcasting to get on with another project. So wish you best of luck with that, Kyle, and we hope to see you again in a month or two's time. But back to this week, dear Ragers. As we have suggested, we are covering a not so much overlooked branch of military history, but certainly one that doesn't get examined and portrayed in sufficient detail. So to open fire on history today, we welcome historian, author, and Colonel of the Canadian Army, Colonel David Grebstad. David, welcome to History Rage.
Hey, thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Feeling angry?
I'm usually angry, but I'm even more so now that I've been thinking about this.
Excellent. I saw what you put out on Twitter earlier that was just like building that level of rage, and you seem to have a following already. So you've come to us by recommendation from our Series 4 Rager, Brad St. Croix, who beautifully took on the myth of Vimy Ridge and its place in Canadian identity. So thank you very much, Brad, for introducing us. But before we dive into tonight's rage, would you give us an insight into just your career, your work, and what led you in this particular field?
Oh, with great pleasure. So as you mentioned up front, I'm Canadian. So I'm joining you from our national capital in Ottawa, but I'm originally from a small town called Dryden, Ontario, which is located for your European listeners and the Americans, and actually most Canadians probably don't even know where that is. It's a very small town halfway between the cities of Thunder Bay and Winnipeg. But the key thing is that I'm a serving officer in the Canadian Army. So I first enrolled in the Canadian Army. My mother essentially frog-walked me into the local armory when I was 16 and said, my son wants to join the Canadian Army Reserve. And months later, I was enrolled. So I joined the 116th Independent Field Battery Royal Canadian Artillery in 1990. 9 years later, after university and having worked in a printing shop and a pet store and various other things, I said, I need a career. So I transferred to the regular force. And in 1999, I transferred from the reserves to the regular force. So I've spent the last 24 years as an artillery officer in the regular Canadian Army. And in that capacity, I've served in the 1st and 2nd Regiments Royal Canadian Horse Artillery, as well as a number of other headquarters jobs at both the, well, at the tactical and strategic levels as well. I've been fortunate to deploy as a forward observation officer to Afghanistan in 2002. And additionally, I'm a qualified instructor in gunnery, which means I took the 10-month intensive instructor in gunnery course at the Royal Regiment of Canadian Artillery School. And that's what we, who have gone through it, call the Masters of Artillery. Most people who haven't done it generally chide us for saying that. But we consider it to be a bit of a Masters of Artillery. My current job is I'm employed as the G1 of the Canadian Army. And if you or your listeners aren't familiar with the kind of classic continental staff system that are what most Western militaries are using, that's the branch responsible for personnel and administration issues. So I'm essentially the head HR dude for the Canadian Army. But most colonels have a secondary duty, and my secondary duty is I'm the regimental colonel of the Royal Regiment of Canadian Artillery. And in that capacity, I work with the rest of the regimental leadership to nurture the regimental family, to connect with Canadians, and to celebrate our regimental heritage. And as you mentioned, I'm also an amateur historian, and my undergraduate degree, which I got from the University of Manitoba, it was in history. My master's degree, which I got from the University of New Brunswick, was in military history. So at the confluence of my professional role as an artillery officer and my love of history, it's led me to research and write several works on the artillery throughout my career. In particular, I'll highlight that I've started in 2006. I wrote an article for the Canadian Army Journal called The Role of the Artillery in Afghanistan. But thereafter, that wasn't really history focus. It was more on the nuances of the use of artillery in our conflict in Afghanistan. But thereafter, I've written several articles for peer-reviewed academic journals. Most notably, I'd like to highlight Wilfrid Laurier University's Canadian Military History Journal. Pardon me. So these articles include, I wrote one article on the 1st Canadian Divisional Artillery in Operation Husky in Sicily in 1943. Another article on the Canadian Army's fire support system in Normandy, so with using an assault on Verrier Ridge in July of 1944 as a case study. And then finally, an article on the fire plan that supported 1st Canadian Army's Operation Veritable in February 1945. But most recently, I've had a book published by Double Dagger Books entitled Iron Indignation, The Evolution of Canadian Artillery Tactics and the Victory at Vimy Ridge. As you mentioned previously, that's a bit of a mouthful. I had to have an extra large cover for the book just to get the title in there. But this book...
A hell of a spine to read it down the side, isn't it?
That's for sure. It's an ends, ways, means analysis of the evolution of the Imperial fire support system during the Great War, leading up to the Battle of Arras with a focus on the Canadian Corps attack on Vimy Ridge, which was, of course, part of that attack on Vimy Ridge. So I've done that, which will probably lead into our next conversation point, because I really feel the story of the artillery, as you mentioned at the outset, is not told well enough and not in great enough detail in most historical narratives.
Okay, so that is then the nub of today's rage then. So do you want to put that into rage speak then? So if I ask you, what is the one thing you wish everybody would just stop believing, or just get over, or just do better? Go.
Certainly. I am furious. I'm absolutely livid that that in the vast majority of cases, the historical narrative of the artillery has gone untold. And that's with the exception of a few works that are specifically dedicated to the artillery. But other than those, the artillery's role in major battles and campaigns is absolutely glossed over, and normally just focuses on the number of guns. It was bigger than Al Alamein, they'll say, but you don't know what the work that went into it. Or they focus on the duration of the barrage or the number of rounds fired. And those are, of course, very, very important details. But what's left out are the literal thousands of men who worked to make that happen. And, of course, in modern conflict, women. And huge swaths of the historical narrative that goes untapped and untold. And the stories of the efforts, the Herculean efforts of gunners, their heroism, they're completely left out of the pages of historical books.
Yeah, this should actually just think of it's not a Second World War example, but one of my favorite little bits of history is Victorian and the Anglo-Zanzibar War, which is currently Britain's shortest ever war. Because as I understand, it is a 48-minute artillery barrage followed by a surrender. And the thing is, that's all I know about it. And I'm really fascinated by this. So yeah, it is overlooked. There is a whole lot more going on.
It certainly, and I understand that people don't necessarily want to dig into too many details, but I'm not familiar with that conflict overly, so I'm not sure exactly what year it would happen. But for a 48-minute barrage at that time period, I assume it was mid-19th century.
Yeah, we're looking at sort of early Victorian, and like I could look up the date. I don't have it to hand, but yeah, so it's mid-19th century.
So for each gun to fire for 48 minutes, there was no recoil systems at that point in history, and the guns would physically roll back, and then the gunners would have to push them forward into position, reload through a number of drills. All that ammunition had to be brought forward. So there's this entire kind of symphony of actions that go on in the background. And I understand nobody wants to write a book about how you swab a gun barrel, but it's a huge part of the historical narrative. That's reductio ad nauseum there, ad absurdum there, but it is a part of the historical narrative that doesn't get discussed. Sam.
Okay, so let's dive in to start off with. Then is you mentioned a few there at the start, but what significant historical events or battles have heavily relied on artillery, Zanzibar aside, but are rarely discussed in popular culture?
I think before we launch into that, if you will indulge me just for a minute or two, I think it's important to clarify what we mean when we say artillery here, because word artillery has over the years come to mean a great many things. So my intent here and my work has focused mostly on what might be considered field artillery, or to sum it up, I guess more succinctly, surface-to-surface artillery. Mm-hmm. And that could be field artillery, medium, garrison, siege artillery, rocket artillery even. But throughout its history, artillery has encompassed a number of different firing systems, whether it's air defense artillery, which used to be called anti-aircraft in the Second World War, now known as air defense in many armies, even anti-tank artillery, especially during the Second World War. So I don't want to disparage those elements of would be the pantheon of artillery fires. But my focus in my research and what I'll discuss here is mostly on the surface-to-surface fires, which would be your classic cannon artillery. I actually think artillery plays a large role in a number of the historical battles we talk about. And because of my focus has mostly been the First and Second World War, artillery played a role in almost all of them. So I don't know that artillery is not mentioned outright, but my concern and my rage has always been that it hasn't been gone into sufficient detail. So when you think of something like the Battle of the Somme, we knew there was a large barrage that preceded it. And we know that in the Battle of the Somme, the infantry didn't keep up with the barrage and in certain circumstances and various other elements. And so that's kind of the surface level understanding of it. And I'm just using the Somme as one example. But what isn't understood is the background to that and how the evolution of tactics throughout the Great War had changed to the point where for the Battle of the Somme, as an example, the system wasn't in place to facilitate maneuver. There weren't enough guns. There wasn't enough ammunition. The resupply wasn't there. But more importantly, the tactics, techniques, and procedures hadn't been refined. So we know there's a lot of artillery that was used in the Somme, for example, but we know it goes down in history as being unsuccessful. And in some circumstances, the artillery may be blamed for that. But nobody really, except in very kind of dense artillery-focused works, realizes the whole background to why it wasn't ready at that point.
Okay, so do you want to give us kind of what those procedures and tactics were?
I think the focus there needs to be ammunition. And by the time the Somme rolled around in the Great War, the static trench warfare had become the norm. Essentially, it was siege warfare on an extended scale. And it wasn't until there were sufficient guns, ammunition, sufficient men to man the guns, and sufficient coordination and tactics, techniques, and procedures to actually deliver that fire, which didn't happen until the spring offensive in 1917, we did not have the fire support required to actually enable maneuver. So I think that to answer your question, the biggest weakness there in my mind was a lack of ammunition, but also an unfamiliarity with what would come to be, at least during the artillery destruction phase of the Great War, the creeping barrage and the use of the creeping barrage to suppress the enemy during an advance. Now, of course, there might be people out there who are thinking that I'm suggesting the barrage wasn't used at the Somme, which is not the case. There were barrages used even before the Somme. But all the necessary elements, specifically the availability of ammunition, just weren't in place at that time to make it as effective as it could be, which it later became, for example, at the Battle of Arras.
Yeah, so my thinking in this instance, the difference being the creeping barrage is there is a whole load of explosions and firepower going off that is slowly moving forward and your infantry is moving behind that. And then when that the artillery barrage sweeps over the enemy, the infantry come in and mop up what's left. Whereas before at the Somme, you are unleashing this enormous barrage to try and blow the hell out of anything that's there, and then the artillery are coming out and charging once that's stopped. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I would say that that's a pretty good encapsulation of what was happening. In essence, the creeping barrage, as you mentioned, creeps forward at small lifts, and the intent being that the infantry should follow it as closely as possible. And sometimes a lot of people, when they consider the artillery, they think of the destructive aspect of the artillery, but it's actually very, very difficult to destroy something with the artillery. And especially when we start talking about dugouts and trenches and reinforced trenches and pillboxes and things like that, they're absolutely quite resilient against artillery fire. And if you, for example, if you wanted to destroy a pinpoint target, let's say a machine gun nest, it takes an awful lot of artillery to actually do that, because artillery has this natural beaten zone and natural inaccuracy in the follow shot. In modern artillery, we've corrected for that by the development of precision guided munitions that are guided by GPS and whatnot. But in the First World War and the Second World War, we lacked that level of accuracy. But so to return to that point, we focus a lot of people focus on the destructive element of the artillery, but we learned, especially during the artillery destruction phase, ironically, that the suppressive effect of the artillery is really what's key. So as that artillery barrage crept forward during the first and Second World War, the infantry would follow close on the heels of that, with the intent being that by the time it lifted off of the objective, which would be an enemy trench, hopefully the enemy would be stupefied and unprepared for the infantry who would follow closely on the heels of that barrage, who would then leap into the trenches and do what infantry do, which is to close with and destroy the enemy. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the French army, there was a rule that if anything less than 15% of casualties were caused by anything other than their own artillery, the infantry wasn't following the barrage close enough, and the orders were you need to get closer. So they actually expected their infantry be so close to the barrage that 15% of the casualties were caused by their own artillery. And that's where you hear the term, if you read it, you know, like hugging the barrage, or staying close to the barrage, or leaning into the barrage. That's where those terms come from.
Okay, you'd mentioned a few kind of other operations there, notably Operation Veritable, that I know you wanted to speak about. So can you, because that's a new one on me. My expertise in terms of Canada and Second World War is limited at best. So you'd like to tell us about Operation Veritable, what it was there to do, and how the artillery were involved.
Certainly. Veritable was the largest operation that the 1st Canadian Army undertook during the Second World War. And it was specifically, it was designed to clear a tract of land adjacent to the Rhine River, with the intent of setting up the launching point for the crossing of the Rhine into Germany by other formations later on. So for this assault, the 1st Canadian Army had under command the 2nd Canadian Corps, but also the 30th British Corps. But also in support of it, the 1st Canadian Army had this massive arsenal of artillery, mostly British, that were allocated to it to enable it to fight its way through the very rigorous defenses of the German forces at the time. And so everybody spoke at the time that it was bigger than Al Alamein. Up until that point, Al Alamein had been the standard by which all barrages had been judged. But for Operation Veritable, it became the largest barrage in, let's say, British and Commonwealth artillery history during the Second World War. It was eclipsed mere weeks later with the crossing of the Rhine, sadly. But for a brief moment, it was the standard barrage by which everybody judged the weight of fire. And while it's fascinating in its own right in how it was creeping barrage was used in to support most of the divisions during their advances, what's really fascinating, which really tells the overall story of the artillery, is the amount of work that went into the Veritable fire plan to set it up for success. So by this point in the Second World War, by February 1945, so close to the end, no attacks would go in without a substantial amount of artillery support. So artillery became what we call a combat indicator. So if the Germans would recognize where reinforcing and general support, higher echelon artillery was being allocated to support, they would know the direction from which assaults were coming. So all this artillery, and I apologize, I don't have the total number of guns to hand that were used in it, but all of this artillery had to be deployed into the 1st Canadian Army area of operations over the space of several weeks at night, and then camouflaged at night. But moreover, so that's one combat indicator, actually, the allocation of the guns. But in addition, the allocation of ammunition. And just thousands and hundreds of thousands of ammunition had to be pre-located, or dumped into the 1st Canadian Army location in order to prepare for this massive barrage that was going to be fired on D-Day. And that all had to be done at night. So when I go back to the original point of why I'm so angry is that there is this huge network of tens of thousands of gunners who, over the space of several weeks, operating at night with nothing but a flashlight with paper or a rag wrapped around it to deaden the light, moving these thousands, tens of thousands of tons of ammunition over swampy, quagmire-like roads into position, and then in the dead of night, digging these rounds into trenches to protect them, all in these sodden fields in the Netherlands. And you don't really hear about that, the efforts that all of these men underwent to prepare for that. So it's one thing for let's say a gunner or a bombardier, which is the equivalent of a private or a corporal in infantry battalions. Mm-hmm. They had to carry all this ammunition and dig it in and prepare the gun positions at night and all in secret. So that of course is a lot of work, but there's, alongside this, there are almost an army of staff officers who have calculators and maps and movement tables and are trying to coordinate this symphony of vehicles driving and ammunition being dropped here, picked up there, and moved here, and also then planning the actual barrage, allocating the timings for all of these firings. So, and all this in the most of the historical narratives, this gets boiled down to, there was a very large barrage that consisted of X number of guns, and it was very effective, or it wasn't effective, depending. So you've got these hours, thousands of man hours of preparation and work going on that never get dealt with, but were absolutely necessary for that barrage to work, or for any barrage to work. All of those millions of moving pieces that led up to it were absolutely critical for any assault to be effective. And sadly, those stories just don't get told.
Yeah, I suppose there is a whole logistical nightmare that covers 10 minutes of firestorm.
Certainly.
And it's just the 10 minutes of firestorm that gets talked about.
Exactly. As there's an old saying, and I don't know who said it, but it resonates, is that amateurs talk about tactics, but professionals talk about logistics. And nothing is nothing is more true than in the realm of the artillery.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So just out of interest, once that whole firestorm starts, and I hate to cut to the firestorm point given what we've just said, but there's actually an awful lot of work that goes into not just prepping for that to happen, but actually getting it to land in the right place and all that sort of thing. I mean, you know, your average gunner is not a guy that just pulls the cord and watches the bang and waits 23 seconds for the second bang. There is a whole load of talent and intelligence and maths and trajectory planning and drills that go into making that barrage not just effective in the right place, but sustained as well. What's an average gunner or gun crew actually have to do in that drill, in that cycle?
That's a great question. And that's, again, is one of those stories that just doesn't get told, sadly. And it's not glorious. It doesn't have the sanguine excitement of an infantryman jumping into a trench and bayoneting German, but though that crew is extremely busy for hours on end. And from the moment they roll into position, and we're talking the First and Second World War, digging a gun pit for the gun, usually at night, stacking the ammunition, preparing the gun pit. And then when the barrage finally goes off, it's a constant laying and checking the lay of the gun, loading the gun, firing. Again, not terribly exciting, but there's a bit of a challenge in the onerous nature of it as well. And this is always done normally in the middle of the night or whatnot. And it's something for those gunners to maintain that for hours at a time. And it's important, though, that it's, as you mentioned, it's not just a matter of putting the round up the barrel and pulling the lanyard. Because if we're talking a creeping barrage, every so many minutes, it has to, the elevation and the bearing of the gun has to change in order to hit the next line of the barrage. So it takes a excellent leader in the form of a detachment commander, normally a sergeant, to maintain the timing. His second in command is making sure the right ammunition is being loaded and for the gunners to constantly load and make sure after every round is fired, they have to verify the lay of their gun, which is to say the elevation and the bearing, because the shock of the gun could cause it to nudge off of its aiming point. And as I mentioned earlier, if the infantry is that close to the barrage, even the most minuscule of errors can result in what we call a friendly fire incident or a blue on blue or a round landing short. And that is the worst thing that could possibly happen to an artillery crew, is if they were to fire an error, which is to say fire their gun at the wrong time, or with the wrong ammunition, or with the wrong data applied to the bearing and elevation. So there's a degree of attention to detail and intense professionalism that has to go into this to ensure that those rounds are being delivered at the time required, the proper rounds are being fired, and at the proper bearing and elevation as well. So you're absolutely right. It's not just inane load, pull, load, pull, load, pull of the lanyard. There's so much more that goes into that whole process. And sadly, I think the average person reading a historical book wouldn't know that would be happening in the background.
Yeah. I haven't fired anything of kind of that level of technology, but I have got some experience of firing a medieval cannon.
Oh, wow.
And for that is very much, it is rate of fire as you think. So it goes off, you've got to worm that out, and then you've got wet mop in, and then dry mop in, and then back out, and then charge in, shot in, wad, ram, prick, prime, light, bang. And you can try and do that. I mean, we can do probably about 2 a minute. I don't think we've ever got up to three, but it is, rate of fire is actually secondary in the medieval period to accuracy.
Yeah.
But how it's, you know, is the rate of fire just as important now as it would have been then?
It certainly is. And just as a bit of a digression before I get back to that, thank you for sharing that, because that's absolutely fascinating. There's a tradition in the artillery that, at least in the Canadian Army, I believe it's in the British artillery as well, that we hand over commands standing at ease. So in your average infantry battalion, when the commanding officer walks on the parade square, the battalion is called to attention. Whereas in the artillery, when the commanding officer of a regiment comes on, the artillery remains, or a battery commander for that matter, remains standing at ease. And this tradition goes back to Napoleon, apparently, who granted his gunners the right to stand at ease when he came on parade. Because as you just illustrated, they were working so hard. And not to diminish the efforts of an ancient or even Napoleonic level gunner, for example, or sorry, infanteer, for an example, but the infantry stood around a lot, I would say, you know, and then marched and they'd fire. And of course, they'd get into bayonet clashes. And of course, that was a bloodthirsty affair. But the gunners for hours on end would be doing, as you pointed out, a loading, swabbing. And what's not seen with most reenacting guns is when that gun fires, because there's no recoil system, it would actually roll back a number of feet. So the gunners would actually have to push it back into the firing position and then carry on all those drills that you mentioned. But to go back to your original question, certainly rate of fire is absolutely key, especially when we're talking about the suppressive effect that artillery tends to achieve. So it's been a debate in artillery circles for decades whether it would be better to fire one large gun and that would land near the target, but fire very, very slowly because they necessarily take longer to fire. Or could you fire a smaller gun, but at a higher rate of fire? And the lessons learned that came out of Veritable, actually, at the end of Veritable, a team of instructors in gunnery and assistant instructors in gunnery did a bit of a battlefield survey and interviewed prisoners of war and actually went and measured craters and impact craters from the artillery to determine accuracy and the effect. And their conclusion was that a smaller caliber gun fired at a higher rate of fire had a far greater suppressive and neutralizing effect than one larger gun fired at less of a rate of fire. So in that end, that's why I think you see in the First World War, and you had the 18-pounders, the smaller caliber guns in the divisional artillery, they were far more numerous, and the 25-pounders in the Second World War in the divisional artillery were far more numerous, but their rates of fire were intense, and that's where their true effectiveness came. But to go back to one of our original points, the faster it fires means the more ammunition you need, so that entire logistical trail needs to be in place to bring that ammunition forward to feed those hungry guns as they constantly churn out those rounds.
Okay, so we talked a little bit there about evolution. You've got a book on the evolution of Canadian artillery. So in what ways has artillery evolved throughout history, and how has this evolution been ignored?
Yeah, great question. And I think, well, let's start with what we'll call gunpowder artillery, because I think an argument can be made whether Roman catapults and torsion ballistae and whatnot are at least in the family of artillery, but at the very least in 13-4 field artillery or gunpowder artillery used to support land maneuver started, or the first recorded instance is the Battle of Crecy in 1346. Artillery existed before that, but it was generally used to batter walls. But in the Crecy in 1346 was the first time first recorded time at any rate, when cannon were trotted out and actually used in the field of battle against enemy to help facilitate maneuver. So since that time, artillery has evolved considerably. And you can imagine the small cannon that were apt to explode rather than fire in 1346 is vastly different than, let's say, multi-launch rocket system that is currently being used by, for example, the Ukrainians today. There's a vast difference in that. But even though the technology is different, the philosophy is still there. It is still attempting to use firepower to support maneuver. So over history, obviously, the cannons themselves improved, science improved, and by the time we reach the 20th century, well, actually even the mid-19th century, I would say, is the key point. You now have barrels that are reliable, that are not want to explode in front or while firing because of in improvements in metallurgy and in the casting and the building of barrels, for example, have improved to the point that they're much safer. So that's one aspect that the evolution has happened. But a key thing that most people aren't aware of is that the true weapon of the artillery is the projectile, and the barrel or the rocket system or what have you is just a method of delivery. So it's the actual projectile that achieves the effect on the target that we are looking for. And while there are many effects, we basically boil them down to suppress, neutralize, and destroy. Those are the three effects that artillery can apply to an enemy force. So over the course of those centuries, the projectile changed from a cannonball. So in 1346, this ball would come shooting out of the cannon and hopefully smash into somebody and cause some effect on them, until in the 18th century, a man named, a British artillery officer named Henry Shrapnel decided, I think if we put a small bit of gunpowder inside the cannonball and maybe surround it with musket balls and then cause the cannonball to explode, maybe that'll be a little bit more effective. So here we see in the 18th century, the projectile now starts bursting in air. That's where we get airburst munitions. So a lot of people don't know that that the term shrapnel comes from the name of the British artillery officer, Henry Shrapnel, who actually devised it. And artillery purists will get upset when you say that somebody was injured with shrapnel, when really what you're talking about is splinters or fragments of off of artillery pieces, because shrapnel is specifically the small musket balls or ball bearing like device things that came out of shrapnel rounds. So now we see the projectile with the addition of a fuse functioning in the air, and it was far more effective to blow up in the air and shower the target with these musket balls, and later high, like airburst high explosive munitions, showering the enemy with jagged splinters and fragments. So that occurs, and now in modern day, we have, as I mentioned previously, these precision-guided munitions that we can take the error of the beaten zone out of a gun, and with these GPS-guided munitions, land an artillery round within feet of a target, and thus we've increased our ability to actually achieve the destruction effect a lot more by having that accuracy. So that is some of the key evolutions over the course of those centuries that we know of the artillery. But a key point that you alluded to earlier was rate of fire. And perhaps one of the most fascinating revolutions in military affairs that does not get a lot of historical rigor is the revolution in military affairs that occurred with the introduction of the famed 75 millimeter, the French Soixante Quinze, which came out in the latter half of the 19th century, which was one of the first guns that actually had a built-in recoil system. So whereas previous to that, as we mentioned, guns would have to be pushed back into place, in this case, with the introduction of the Soixante Quinze, a round could be loaded, the gun could fire, the barrel would recoil, but the gun itself would stay in place. And with the various systems that were used, the barrel would slide back into place, the breech could be opened by the gunner, and it could be reloaded, and pardon me, the gun fired at a much higher rate of fire. All of that swabbing and whatnot and moving the gun back into position was no longer used. So it's from that various German cannons eventually, they were slow. They didn't pick up on the quick fire revolution, as it was called, but it's from that quick fire revolution that was started by the French Soixante Quinze that we get the venerable 18 pounder that the British and Canadian and various other imperial artillery used in the First World War, and which is now used in modern guns as well. The same, almost conceptually, the same recoil system is used in almost all field pieces now. So that's just some of the ways that artillery evolved over the centuries to become far more effective. But sadly, a lot of those elements of the historical narrative, they're not touched on either.
So how has the lack of coverage of artillery impacted our understanding of, well, not just historical battles and warfare strategies, but how does it affect our up-to-date understanding of warfare strategies as well?
That's a great question. I would say that the lack of understanding of artillery has caused us to two things: one historical, and one I would say properly professional. Is two points I want to make. The first one is historically we don't fully understand the true reasons behind why certain operations or campaigns unrolled the way they did. And we talked about the Somme earlier on. And to go back to that point, I think the historical narrative and most people's general understanding of the Somme was that we just didn't have the doctrine down, or it was lions led by donkeys. It was stupidity at its worst. But the real narrative is that there's the systems that were required just weren't in place yet. And consequently, if more people knew that, they may reassess some of those campaigns, some of those battles in the past. So I think that was my first point from a historical perspective. But I also want to move from the historical to the modern. And we keep relearning old lessons. So one of the key weaknesses in the artillery system in 1916 was the lack of shells. You've probably heard of the shell crisis of 1915, 1916. An entire British government fell because of this, because there weren't enough shells. There wasn't enough ammunition that for the British armies to use in the field. Now, fast forward to the conflict in Ukraine. And if you're following the news, it's the same issue. There's not sufficient ammunition available for the Ukrainian armies to achieve the effect that they want to achieve in their fight against the Russians. So as the old saying goes, it may be apocryphal. I think it's ascribed to Mark Twain. I'm not sure, but history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So the shell crisis of 1915 is not exactly the same as perhaps what we are experiencing with an ammunition crisis in Ukraine right now, but they resonate. There's so much similarity in the two. And it's because we forget our lessons. At the start of the Second World War, artillery started the war decentralized. All of the lessons of the First World War were forgotten. And it wasn't until they were relearned, and essentially when Montgomery decreed that divisional artilleries were essentially supposed to be used as a 72-gun battery instead of penny-packeted around the battlefield, he was just stating an obvious fact that had been learned in the First World War, that the concentration of fires, massive concentration of fires, was absolutely key. So we keep relearning these lessons. And maybe we relearn them because we're forgetting them. And I'd like to share one anecdote with you. When I gave you my brief bio at the start, and I transferred to the regular force in 1999. Being a bilingual country, it was mandated at the time I had to do 8 or 9 months of French training to learn French. All officers are expected to be able to converse with English and French soldiers in the Canadian Army. So I spent 9 months at the Canadian Forces Language School, and over an adult beverage in the mess one day, a colleague of mine on the same course who was infantry, and like me, he had transferred from the reserve force. He was an infantier. And he looked at me one day, he said, "Why are you staying with the artillery?" And this was 1999. The Cold War was over. Peace had broken out everywhere. And he looked at me and said, "It's a dying trade. Why would you stay with the artillery? It's not going anywhere. We're probably going to divest ourselves of it. And all future fire support will probably be just close air support or attack helicopters." And he was speaking earnestly, that he actually believed that. But fast forward now to the conflict in Ukraine, or even the conflict in Afghanistan. And once again, artillery proved its battle winning, its war winning capability. And we're seeing it now playing out in the Ukraine. Or the Ukraine-Russia conflict. So one of the reasons I'm so adamant about telling these stories is because we need to stop relearning them every 10, 15, 20 years. We can't just keep blowing the dust off the old book, say, "Well, let's see what they did in the past and see if it's applicable today," because it always is. And we relearn these lessons. And sadly, we relearn them at great cost in not just treasure, but in blood. And in the lives of young men and women who are serving their country. So our Army commander, he has said numerous times, he said, "If you want to learn something new, read an old book." I'm not sure if he's quoting somebody, but it's a great phrase that I've been using quite a bit. And I'm hoping by my research and my presentations that we don't have to relearn that all the time, but we embed that in our knowledge going forward.
Yeah, which kind of leads me then into the last question, really, which was, you know, can you tell us about recent efforts or initiatives? It's going to give you an opportunity to plug your book here, but yeah, you go for it. That are aimed at addressing this lack of coverage, and what impact has that had?
Yeah, I will shamelessly plug my book, Iron Indignation, and that was, as I mentioned at the outset, my
shameless plugs are the best kind.
Yeah, my goal in that was to describe down to what the gunner was doing, what the team driver was doing, what the signaler was doing, to put all those pieces together to give a more holistic approach to things. So So that's one effort. But there are some works that do go into detail. And more shameless plug, all of my articles that I wrote for Canadian Military History Journal was just that as well, to show the preparation, everything that goes behind the barrage or the bombardment. There are some works that touch on it. And the first one that jumps to mind, it's a bit aged now. I think it came out in the 80s, but he's a Brit, but Major General J.B.A. Bailey's Field Artillery and Firepower is absolutely, it's incredibly dense, but he goes into a lot of detail about the technical aspects. And I think if you ever read this book, you'll find that almost every page, half of the page is footnotes, in which he just, he doesn't put it in the actual text, but he's like, oh, by the way, and he adds little nuanced context to whether it's a technical or tactical element that should be highlighted, but may not fit right into the narrative. But throughout it all, it's just this very profound analysis of the history of field artillery and firepower. And I'm hoping that we're learning from our observation of what's happening in the Ukraine right now, the value of artillery. And certainly coming out of Afghanistan, we now have I can tell from a professional perspective, I think that same officer that I shared the anecdote with, I imagine if I were to approach him in the mess again today, he would be singing a different tune. I know him, I still know him personally, and I know he deployed to Afghanistan several times, and I'm quite confident that he would have changed his tune and realized the war-winning and battle-winning capability of the artillery. So we now have, at least in the Canadian Army, and I would probably say in most Western armies, a cohort of professional officers who have seen the value of artillery and seen it firsthand and are applying that in their day-to-day, in their day-to-day to approach to business. So I would say those are some of the more recent observations and developments that will hopefully shed a brighter light on the more intricate nature of the artillery system.
Well, thank you very much, David. Thank you. Because I was as guilty as the next man of thinking, well, it's just, you know, it's all how many guns and how many rounds. But no, thank you very much. Do you feel better?
I do feel better. It's good to get that off my chest. Thank you very much for allowing me that time. And I hope there's not too many infantry soldiers and engineers and tankers or cavalry officers or whatnot who are rolling their eyes at me and whatnot. I whenever I get on a rant like this, I do like to start off with, and I'm sorry I missed it here, is that I'm not trying to besmirch the courage of the maneuver arms, be it infantry, cavalry, armor, you name it, the combat engineers as well. I'm not trying to suggest that the artillery is any more important. It's just that there's a story that needs to be told that hasn't been, and the artillery's proper role is part of a comprehensive joint arm, including all the maneuver elements and the support elements as well. And we each have an equally important role to play on the modern battlefield.
Yeah, nicely covered there. Nicely covered. Well, if you would like to know more about this subject, then you can and should check out David's book, Iron Indignation. We will have links to that in the show notes. And you can follow David on Twitter at David Grebstab as well. So tankers, cavalrymen out there, if you want to take him on, you now know where to find him. So, but once again, David, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was fantastic.
And ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. We would really appreciate any reviews you could leave for us with Apple or Podchaser or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage. Me individually, I am at Paul Bavel and Kyle is at Kyle G History. And if you're loving this, then please support us on Patreon. In return for your cherished £5 per month, we will give you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the invite to put questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until next week, stay angry. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.